The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening. My name is Morris Williams, and it is my privilege to welcome each of you to another wonderful evening for the author series at the Free Library of Philadelphia. I hope that as you consider your charitable contributions against the backdrop of a rising stock market, that you will continue to make the Free Library part of your charitable support, because the Free Library is so important, particularly in terms of helping our young people as they deal with the impact of a COVID crisis over the past year, and with the summer programs the Free Library offers, as well as Read by Four. I think the Free Library merits your support. This evening, we're of course delighted to have Dr. Paul Farmer in conversation with Dr. Stephen Larson. Dr. Larson is a professor of emergency medicine at the Hospital of University of Pennsylvania, but like Paul, he does extensive work with the immigrant population and noted earlier that the immigrant population represents 15% of the workforce here in Philadelphia. Dr. Farmer's new book, Fevers, Feuds, and Diamonds, is an excellent review of the Ebola crisis of 1914 and links the outbreak of that ongoing crisis to our COVID-19 crisis. Disease, death, broken systems, and heroes are just a few of the highlights of Dr. Farmer's book, which I highly recommend for you to purchase and share with others. Now stay tuned. Physician, infectious medicine disease expert, Paul Farmer is the Cola Tironas University Professor and Chair of Global Health and Social Medicine at Harvard University and Chief of the Division of Global Health Equity at Boston's Brigham and Women's Hospital. Now, if that wasn't enough responsibility, Paul is also a co-founder of Partners in Health, where he continues to work to advance healthcare for disadvantaged people, particularly in Haiti and Rwanda. As I offer my thanks to Dr. Farmer for joining us today and for the example that he has set for all of us in terms of our need to help others, it is my pleasure to turn the evening over to Drs. Paul and Stephen.
Thank you, Morris.
Thanks for the introduction. I received your book a while back, and I really must say it didn't disappoint. As with all of your writing, you know, as a healthcare provider, there's obviously the connection to the profession that we share. But your distinct perspective as an anthropologist and the social aspects that you bring to light are always powerful and supercharged. And I wasn't disappointed in reading your book. It left me in awe. For those of you who haven't read it, I highly recommend it. And I can tell you, for me personally, you know, the stories that you put in the forefront on individuals like Umar Khan and Martin Saleh really humanized the epidemic, the Ebola epidemic, and really put a human face to it. And honestly, as I read this, you know, your account of Ibrahim and Mariatu in particular really put a human face to this, that I don't know if they were, the tears were of joy, I think, as Ibrahim, you know, comes to discover his calling. And that's just a powerful recollection. And thank you for sharing that in advance.
Well, thank you, Steve. You know, it wasn't an easy story to write. And part of that was because, you know, I had gotten close to these patients who became my friends, and Ibrahim, who I just saw last month, you know, is still my coworker, and Mariatu happily is still in school. But for those who haven't read the book, I'll just mention that, we were not early on the scene. I had been there myself for a surgical conference. As Morris said, I'm an infectious disease doctor, not a surgeon, but we had been organizing a Lancet, which is for the non-medical, is a very premier medical journal published in England. And we were taking a look at surgical care in resource poor settings. And the way these Lancet commissions go, as you know, is to have three meetings. And the first one was at Harvard Medical School, and we hosted it. And the third one was in Dubai. So we hadn't even gone into a resource poor setting, and we knew that we needed to sit together and hammer out this report in, what gets called in this book, a clinical desert. Of course, a clinical desert is also a public health desert, and I hope we'll get back to that. So that was in June of 2014. And on the last day that we were there, I'd gone from Rwanda with a pretty big delegation from Rwanda. And the last day we were there, I went to visit a couple of facilities, clinical facilities, the main teaching hospital, where which is a battered colonial relic, was built almost 100 years ago and looked like it. And they were standing up an Ebola treatment unit or holding center or whatever it may be called. And, it was a very discouraging thing. And even though that week there had been no reported cases yet of Ebola in the city, the capital city, which is called Freetown, we had every reason to believe, of course, it was there, including seeing in that hospital, the announcements for really young nurses who had died a couple of days before. And we went to visit another facility as well. Anyway, I left that night for Rwanda and just thought, this is going to be bad. I mean, there were no impediments in the way. And you mentioned Humar Khan, by the way. Last time I was there in Philadelphia, I saw his brother, who lives there and maybe is listening tonight. He came to the last one of these that I did, and I thought about him. Who he was definitely in harm's way further to the east of this. Freetown is on the Atlantic coast, and he was to the east, close to where the epidemic was thought to have started over the border in Guinea. And there were, of course, just as he was in harm's way, maybe more than just about anyone, because he was named the Ebola Czar at about that time, so too were other healthcare providers, nurses particularly at the top of the list, nursing assistants, physicians, people who drove ambulances. But I said it was a clinical desert, so there aren't many of those in Guinea, and there are even fewer in Sierra Leone or Liberia. And in the absence, as you know from your work, Steve, in the absence of health professionals, people take care of their own family members, and the rest of that work is done by traditional healers, and they were all in harm's way. So it was with a real heavy heart that we left that night, and I just felt like we were running away. But we came back. We came back too late, not too late to save a lot of lives, but we came late in the game. We came back as partners in health, because like I said, it doesn't matter if I go somewhere. What you need is a team of hundreds and thousands of people. So, and then we, and in the course of that work, I met Ibrahim and Mariatu, and the story that you mentioned is Ibrahim, who told me the night I met him, actually, he wasn't my patient. He had already recovered or was recovering. He told me that he'd lost 20 members of his family to Ebola. And I just couldn't believe it, because as you know, there aren't that many pathogens that would do that. And, I suspected already, knowing something about Ebola academically, that this was largely not a reflection of the virulence of the organism so much as the virulence of the social conditions that folks were living in. And I still think that's true to this day. So and just to, for the listener, for the audience, I'll just say Mariatu was a a girl, you know, a girl. I mean, you'd think I'd remember if she was eight. I think it was eight. And she had lost her mother and another sibling, and had survived acute Ebola in the sense of having negative blood tests. But she weighed 27 pounds. And she had not spoken a word, according to the nurses, and since she was admitted, not a word. And she hadn't eaten anything. So I was asked by the team there, you know, could she have tuberculosis as well or malignancy? I mean, she was a wraith. She was really emaciated. And you know, that was not her problem. It was, you know, that she was grieving and, you know, and frightened and lonely. And Ibrahim, who'd never met her, on the day that he kept on saying to me, hey, can I do something for Ebola patients? Can I help these patients? I know, you know, what it's like to lose family members. I know what it's like to live through Ebola. And it wasn't my, you know, he's 27 years old, but you know, he was asking my blessing. And when we incorporated him into the workforce, you know, we didn't really know how, maybe as a community health worker or, you know, it wasn't a clinical role we were looking at, even though we suspected, as he said, that he was immune to reinfection. I just remember he walked in to the pediatric ward after Mariatu had been transferred from the Ebola treatment unit to the local public hospital, and where she remained mute and facing the wall and really looking like she was about to die. And he walked into the room, didn't ask which child she was. It was evident enough to him. And he walked down to the end of the ward, sat on her bed. And then I saw something I just will never forget, that, you know, she clutched at his shirt sleeve and pulled herself up to his ear and whispered something. Now, right then, there was another dramatic event. Another child had a seizure, which should never have happened because she had had a seizure before and wasn't properly medicated. And so I was busy dealing with that problem and mess. And it took me a while to get a moment alone with Ibrahim. And I said, well, what did she say? You know, and she said, well, there's this certain kind of cookie I like, and I'm really partial to this kind of juice. And I just stood there and went, you gotta be kidding. And the whole nursing staff, all the doctors who were there were saying, she can't speak, she maybe has brain damage. She did not. And watching him nurse her back to life and to see the real Mariatu, as he said, was really the reason that I wrote this book. After seeing that, I just thought, I wanna write about this. I wanna see it again and again, of course, but I also, that's really was the inspiration to write this book. How did I do?
Spot on. I mean, that is exactly, you know, for those of us who've seen situations like that, it's the reason we go back and we engage. You know, when someone like Ibrahim, who, if I'm not mistaken, lacked formal education and had very limited skill sets, found himself in this situation. I mean, what a beautiful story, and just very uplifting, definitely. One of the dominant themes, I guess we could flip over to some of the medical sort of interesting sides of things that you come again and again at the audience, the reader with, is the control over care kind of theme. It's fascinated me because I'm at the other end of the spectrum where I work in a veritable cornucopia of supplies and resources. And the other side, the biomedical side or the care side is full on, but the other piece of it is missing.
Yeah.
Maybe you could comment on that control over care theme that dominates this book and talk about it more for the audience.
Yeah, I mean, it is more than anything the thread through the book. And I can just say that, you know, having worked on responding to epidemics for all my professional life, I went to Haiti in 1983 when I hadn't even started medical school. And I saw something early on there, which I later heard repeated, not in medical schools, but in schools of public health. And I knew there was this, I thought, outrageous failure to remember that prevention does fail, that people get injured, that they get sick. and that they need care. And the chilliness of international, it was called International Health at the time, as you'll remember, because we were training at about the same time, you know, was just, it was all about, you know, if I could just tell one little story, I took a class at Harvard when I was a med student, and it was at the School of Public Health that which is right across the courtyard from the medical school and close to the Brigham and Women's Hospital where I work to this day. And, you know, I was so gung-ho about learning about public health. I still am gung-ho. But, you know, the idea of doing a diagnosis of the burden of disease, of understanding what the ranking problems were for a community, whether that community was a squatter settlement like the one I worked in Haiti, or a nation state, or a city like Philadelphia. You know, what's the burden of disease? What are the top five causes, say, of death among children, adults? You know, these are things that we can seek to know. And what are we going to do about them? And in this class, I remember there was a Haitian guy in the class, and most of the students taking the class were already nurses or physicians. I very few of them didn't have a professional degree. And there was a Haitian physician in the class. And I said to him, you know, in Creole, so what do you do if you're in a squatter settlement in rural Haiti? And he said, well, ask. So I asked the professor, you know, how do you set priorities, you know, in a place like that? And the response was, well, you do Gobi. And, you know, I thought the Gobi was a desert in Mongolia. You know, I didn't know that it meant you do growth monitoring, oral rehydration, promote breastfeeding and immunization. And, you know, I was just thinking, well, what if you have leukemia? What if you get hit by a car? What if you, you know, the kind of folks that you see in the emergency room? And I just, all my life since then, year in, year out, I've seen it again and again. It's not possible to treat AIDS in Africa. It's not cost effective. It's not feasible. It's not sustainable. It's not even prudent. And I never heard that in Haiti from, you know, unless it was from public health authorities. I never heard that in Rwanda. I never heard that in Boston. I never heard that in Chiapas, you know, that, well, for us, prevention will have to suffice. And, you know, a lot of the work that Partners in Health does is to counter that pernicious logic of control over care. It's not that we don't want control. Who wouldn't? You know, nobody was taking care of Ebola patients, did not want to see transmission halted and promptly. But people did get sick. Maybe 50,000 of them. I know the number we hear is 35,000, but how do we know, right? Because a clinical desert is also a public health desert. And so I have a real rancor, an animus about this stance, which seems to me is largely applied to poor people and Black people and brown people. And, you know, we saw it in the Ebola response, and, you know, we don't want to see it around COVID either. And so I don't know that's, and the roots of this, Steve, were really in colonial medicine. So this is before the neoliberal paradigm that we labor under now. This was well entrenched as formal policy by French, British, and German, at the very least, I'm sure Portuguese and other, you know, colonizers. And it really came to the fore in the late 19th and 20th centuries after the development of vaccines and a lot of other wonderful tools. But again, there was no effort to build out a healthcare system. And just as an example, the British were in Sierra Leone, not for 100 years, but for 200. And when they left in the early 60s, at the end of colonial rule, they had established all of zero medical schools and, amazingly to me, zero nursing schools. So the catch up that had to be done in the post-colony was, you know, and is to this day, even if war had not made it much worse and wrecked what was built, the catch up has to go on now, the catching up. Because a control over care paradigm is, of course, not only inhumane, but also rejected by pretty much anybody who is ill or injured or their family members. And, you know, some of the mistrust of the medical systems that we keep hearing about are because we don't do a good job taking care of, you know, people who live in poverty. And again, in the United States, you know, there are plenty of vulnerable communities who might feel the same kind of anxiety about this.
Well, it resonated with me, Paul, in working in West Philadelphia and, you know, seeing the interpersonal violence and, the, you know, particularly the gunshot victims time and time again roll through. And, you know, you realize that the problem isn't within the four walls of that institution. It's out in the community. And it has to do with this sort of control kind of public health interventions and education and things like that. But the truth is, and I think this is what I got out of your book, when a person is an extremist and leaving out from you, the last thing they want to hear is about interpersonal violence. That just doesn't. You've got to build the trust. You have to make that commitment. You've got to go where they are. You've got to show up. You have to be serious, and you have to continue. It's a process of building that trust.
You know, I couldn't agree more, and it's been my experience in all the places I've worked. And as you know, Steve, it's not like I jump, like Partners in Health jumps around. You know, anytime we've gone to work in a new place, we've stayed. So we're still working in Haiti. We have over 6,000 employees in Haiti, all Haitian, of course, et cetera, et cetera. Rwanda is the other largest program. But we're not jumping around. And everywhere I've worked, when people say, well, how, you know, they're so mistrusting. And again, the term, interestingly, in Sierra Leone and Liberia and Guinea is still the natives. You know, they still say, well, the natives are so mistrusting. And, you know, people would say, well, how do you address that? Well, you address it by doing just what you said. You work humbly, consistently, visibly and reliably to address the needs that they're identifying. And, you know, trust grows quite naturally. That's been our experience everywhere as well.
Well, that came through clearly in your book, and I really appreciated that. Quick question, stuff, staff, and space. I like that. Do you have a wish list? Critical care certainly was a topic or a theme that continued to be present in the book. What would be your dream other than running water and electricity and a roof?
Well, you know, the reason that we keep using this silly mnemonic at Partners in Health is because it gets very scary and confusing in the middle of a crisis, right? So, you know, everybody's running around saying, what are the priorities? And everybody has their ideas about what the priorities should be. And so we just keep on going back to that list. Who are the staff we need? What's the stuff, the supplies we need? We didn't have an Ebola vaccine then, but we have one now, right? What is the space that's needed? An Ebola treatment unit can't be just like one of those crowded clinics that we see where there's, you know, just one entrance and everybody's crammed together. What kind of space is needed? Systems is the fourth S. Infection control is a system, but so is paying the nurses for their labor instead of saying, well, you know, you're not going to be paid. And the fifth S is support, and everybody needs that. And so do ministries of health, nurses, doctors. We all need support, right? So if I had to make my wish list, it would vary from place to place. But just going, I was in Sierra Leone last month, you know, and we broke ground on a new women's hospital. So there's an example of the space we need. You know, the staff we need. Well, we finally have some experienced nurse midwives, including one who's really been in charge of this, who is a Sierra Leonean who was in Britain for a long time. But she came back because she thought, if I could have the space and the stuff, I can make a real contribution in my home country. And she is. So, you know, the staff for me, you know, if you start with nurses, and you've done this too, you've work with nurse-run clinics as I have across the world. That's really the best starting point, I think, for the clinicians. Staff, space, I mentioned space, stuff. You know what it takes to run an emergency room. It takes a lot more to run a teaching hospital, because all the clinics and hospitals that we build, we want them to be teaching hospitals for obvious reasons. And then the systems, I mentioned two of them, like actually paying the people for their labor, but also infection control. And there are lots of other systems that are important. And certainly when you're dealing with an outbreak, an epidemic or a pandemic, it's all about systems, you know, once you have the staff in space. And then the support, you know, I saw a patient last month in Sierra Leone who I could see needed an amputation. This was an older person who, I didn't know what was causing his gangrene, it was dry. And, you know, he didn't have diabetes. It was atherosclerosis, I think, in the end. But, you know, and he had his amputation and a revision. And, you know, the team there, and some of them may be listening, so this is not a critique, you know, had prescribed enoxaparin, you know, for, because he's going to be still for a long time. And that's an anticoagulant, as you know. And, you know, this is what I used to see in Haiti back in the 80s, you know, the doctor sees the patient, hardly examines the patient. This is back in the 80s, you know, maybe the magic stethoscope for a second, and then writes a script and gives it to the patient, where they go out and buy it. You know, even the main referral hospital, the public hospital in Haiti, in Port-au-Prince, runs that way. It just means that you put another barrier in front of making the opinion of the clinician, nurse or doctor, irrelevant by putting another barrier in the way. And, you know, so support to patients means at least having the tools of the trade on hand for them. It may also mean, as you've seen, and many others as well, it might mean food support. It might be, you know, and if you actually listen, if you dare to listen to the patients, they're going to start talking, I learned in Haiti back in the 80s, about housing, about getting their kids in school, et cetera, et cetera. So the support part is the most expansive part of it, but it's also in many ways the most supportive, and I mean, most inspiring. I mean, that's what Ibrahim did to bring Mariatu back to life, was to focus on, you know, the social support that she needed to recover and the psychological support that she and her father needed as well.
That's fantastic. I kept seeing that stat, and I saw a report where one of your colleagues had used that in a meeting, and I thought, wow, that's pretty cool.
It's so simple that it's cool.
Yeah. So, you know, as an educator, and we both have been responsible for cadres of the next generation, you know, this idea of social contract that medicine holds up and sometimes struggles to fulfill, how do you see your role and how do you address that, you know, in terms of, you know, your work in an academic institution? And
when the people who launched Partners in Health, you know, formally in 1987, but, you know, if you do the math, I was still a medical student. So was Jim Kim, and Ophelia Dahl was in college, you know, and our Haitian, we had more mature and seasoned Haitian colleagues. And another founder was my roommate in college, you know, and, you know, another, you know, 20 something year old. And we had conviction. And I would just say that we lucked out in, you know, writing our mission statement, but we worked hard on it. It wasn't just luck. You know, because we'd seen a lot for people in our 20s, and so we kind of cribbed our mission statement in a way from a teaching hospital. And what does a teaching hospital do? It takes care of the ill and injured, it trains others to do so, and it generates new knowledge that can help us do it better. And even though our the American healthcare system looks to be in terrible shape, that part of that is because of a divestment in public health and in community health and in family medicine and, you know, and in support. But the primary goal of an American teaching hospital, like the one you work at or the one I work at, is a good one. And so we wrote that right into the mission statement, right? So, you know, we knew that we were going to be trying to do just that. And then, of course, if you make that commitment and put it in a mission statement and then are sort of entrapped into the decency of performing, then you'd have to do things like found universities, as we have in Rwanda, the University of Global Health Equity, right? Where you've promised me to be on the faculty, I believe.
And
I mean it. And, you know, you have to think about, well, you know, if we're going to introduce a new therapy or a, you know, a new vaccine, how do we study how to use it most effectively? Right now with the COVID crisis, we're still not using vaccines in a reactive or strategic way, right? Because they're not being used to halt epidemics yet. Right now, it's all based on demographic risk profiles, which is a very important thing to do. But, you know, you can imagine if you're in a place with very little community-based transmission of the novel coronavirus, that you could stop transmission not only through the conventional public health measures, but with ring vaccination. That's how we, I love saying that's how we stopped smallpox, as if I were around then. But, and you know, the same with Ebola. I was around for that. You know, and research leads to a new vaccine, gets developed by pharma, but it's the basic designs are from academic labs very often, right? And so how are you going to use the new vaccine? And that's how we used it, not only to help end the West African epidemic by doing ring vaccination. What that means, you know, everybody in America now knows what contact tracing is, right? That was not the case 2 years ago. In fact, the editor of the book that we're talking about said, you know, you can't just put in things like social distancing, contact tracing. And then he stopped saying that when, you know, by the time I turned it in, because we were really at the beginnings of the COVID epidemic. But people know what contact tracing is. So if you have a patient who's ill, the people who are in contact with them, or anybody they've been in any contact with at all, depends on if it's an airborne virus, any proximity. It's different with Ebola, and other pathogens are different as well. But that ring around this person or persons, that's ring one to vaccinate. And then if you vaccinate the contacts of the contacts, then you do another ring. And this has proven effective at stopping outbreaks. And I hope that we will soon have enough vaccine, I think we do in the United States, to be more strategic in our use of the vaccine as well. In the middle of massive community-based transmission, you know, we should continue to rely on conventional public health interventions, the ones that we've been promoting for the last 15 months in the United States and elsewhere. But this may be an important use of the vaccine as well. I mentioned that just to say, look how much we don't know, right? And that requires research. And, you know, and so that was part of our mission statement as well. And then the training part, well, you and I do that for a living, right? We're medical professors. And we love that work, right? But imagine trying to respond to irrigate a clinical desert like Sierra Leone without having nursing schools and medical schools, you know? There's no way to do it. I mean, I'm very grateful for all the folks who came to Sierra Leone, and so are the Sierra Leoneans, more to the point, but they were gonna leave, right? And so training the next generation of nurses, physicians, health managers, researchers, that should be very much on the docket of an organization like Partners in Health. And I think other organizations, that's what you do as well, I know.
That's wonderful. We have a little bit of time. For the audience, there are opportunities to ask questions. And as soon as we accrue enough, we'll open that up. A couple of things that I really enjoyed in your writing was the reference constantly back to history. And there was an interlude, down the rabbit hole interlude, where you mentioned Dubois talking about we can only understand the present by continually recurring to and studying the past. And then I think in the same region or thereafter, that you talked about Pasteur and La Touraine. Talk a little bit about the importance of history to you. I mean, I know as an anthropologist, it's huge, but as a practitioner, you know, looking back and incorporating that into your practice.
Well, you know, I would just say as a confession that when we got there, when we returned, when I returned and when we got there as a collective, it wasn't at all my intention to learn about the history of Sierra Leone and Liberia. And I already confessed to you, not in this talk, but I will here publicly, that I really don't feel that I ever got to know, even though I lived there 10 years, all the history, the rich cultural history of Rwanda, right? I know the basics, right? So the responding to Ebola, really what was needed was critical care and supportive care, the kind that you get in an emergency room. At least the supportive care part, the kind that is really largely provided by nurses, as I said. So the things that we were doing and should have been doing is putting in IVs and making sure people had enough to eat and making sure we treated their intercurrent infections or opportunistic infections as they were recovering. Also, what about all the other people who didn't get to go to any clinic or hospital at all because of Ebola and died, like, say, of obstructed labor. I mean, and, you know, we're facing a similar challenge now with COVID. If people can't seek prenatal care or their cancer care, we know what could happen, right? So the history part for me was also something of a reward to myself. I wanted to know about the history of that part of West Africa. Why? Because, you know, in Haiti, you know, even when, you know, there are all kinds of Creole expressions that are from that part of the world, but also, you know, when someone dies in Haiti, it's still common to hear that they went back to Guinea. You know, that's the term, non-Guinée. And, you know, so I would just say that West Africa has always loomed large in my imaginary or my mind. And as an American, you know, who grew up in Florida and Alabama, you know, there were reasons there that were even deeper, at least personally for me, that made me want to do this. So the two things that we need to understand to certainly, maybe not to put in an IV give someone fluid resuscitation when they're in shock, but, you know, to function as a clinician in general, the kind of things that you need to know about to do, I think, a really good job and a respectful job and a job that confers dignity on the patient, you need to know about context. And now I think most medical students or residents would agree, but context doesn't come from nowhere. And so understanding social context ought to imply knowing something about social history. And as I said, you know, my clinical colleagues, whether they were from West Africa or elsewhere, would have rolled their eyes if I had started, you know, pulling out history books about colonial rule in West Africa in the middle of the epidemic. Although I did travel with them, I did have them on hand, but it wasn't my primary goal. And then after meeting Ibrahim and seeing this exchange, and I'm really not exaggerating, it was that moment that I, you know, really said, I'm going to write this book. Then I knew that, you know, if I planned my time out right, I would find a space myself to learn about the place in the way that W.E.B. Du Bois was talking about. And, you know, I wish everybody got a chance to do that. I wish I had a chance to do that in Chiapas. You know, I wish I'd had a chance to do that in Peru or Rwanda, Malawi, Lesotho. But I did want to carve out that space to do that in contemplating West Africa. So that's kind of the way I think of history. Very useful in a pinch sometimes, but always useful in, in building a health system, for example.
Well, Paul, we have a whole bunch of questions coming at you here from the audience, and I'm going to sort of try to throw them your way, okay? From one of the members, what were the locals' cultural views on Ebola's cause? The individual says that she's heard myths about Mami Wata, witchcraft accusations, medical explanations, or a combination of all three. What did you observe? Did witchcraft accusations in Doki increase, or were there other explanations?
Well, you know, I mentioned earlier that there's this vestigial use of the term native in these people's own country, which was a title conferred by the colonial rulers. And interestingly, it took me all of like a week to hear, maybe even less, to hear people, my somewhat embarrassed host from Sierra Leone, talk about native business, which was shorthand for witchcraft or sorcery. I knew that. I mean, I didn't know it ahead of time, but I could figure it out. And they were embarrassed in front of their international peers. But then they found out I was interested in that anyway, interested in learning about it. So to the question, I saw all of it. I saw biomedical explanations, you know, we're invoking a microbe. I heard a lot of sorcery accusations. Just about anything, even heard about Mami Wata, just about anything you could imagine, right? But I also counseled my medical colleagues, including nursing colleagues, to focus on the reason we were there, right? Which was to provide medical care rather than to unravel the mysteries of etiology. And
although I did allow myself that pleasure. And I learned a lot about it and was able to write about it in the book a little bit. And I found what many anthropologists, medical anthropologists, always find, that people are able to maintain multiple explanatory frameworks at the same time, not just within the same family, within the same person. And I think a lot of Americans do that too, you know? So none of it was startling to me. It was all interesting though. And you know, knowing more about what these ideas are surely can help improve the quality of the clinical services that we offer. And again, I think it's really important to be respectful. Everywhere you go, people have their own notions of what causes misfortune of all kinds. And, you know, that is understanding that, I believe, can help us to provide more respectful services.
Fantastic. All right. Dr. Farmer, first of all, I just want to say how grateful I am for you and your work. Your work displayed in Kidder's Mountains Beyond Mountains inspired me to pursue and achieve my MPH. My question is, what is your best advice when it comes to teaching, introducing medical students to a clinic and participant population that aren't used to working in it? I am a clinical coordinator and manage medical students from the Philadelphia area in our clinic in Kensington. Thank you in advance.
Well, thank you for the question and for your career, your vocation. And thank you for including medical students, because medical students and nursing students and all clinicians need to have those kind of experience. So, you know, what I try to do, and this is also when, you know, when we invite senior clinicians to someplace like Rwanda, I try to pull people aside, or residents in Haiti, you know, talking about Haiti, I try to pull them aside and say, you know, one of the real tricks to clinical medicine is knowing when to be quiet and just listen. And saying that to medical students isn't always welcomed with applause, right? But that's an important part of this. Another thing that we do reliably, whether it's at Harvard or in Haiti, is to encourage all clinicians to spend some time doing home visits. So not just like with the ACA, this idea of a medical home. You know, when I first heard the term, I was thinking they meant in people's homes, but no, that was a medical home that was a clinic or, you know, an ambulatory clinic connected to a hospital. But I'm talking about where people live. And, you know, it's never a waste of time to have encourage or have medical students do that. And when I teach, in addition to infectious disease, I teach social medicine at Harvard Medical School and in Rwanda and Haiti as well. And, you know, we ask the students to do home visits and to write about the neighborhoods that they see and what they learned in the household. And again, just getting an hour, you know, a day or two of that in is difficult in our medical curriculum. It still gets crowded out. Penn is a little bit better than most schools, but in, you know, many students, medical schools, and I'm afraid it's true in nursing schools as well, you know, it's like, oh, well, that's not really important. That's just some second, you know, and they bring these ideas with them to medical school. So it doesn't come from them. You know, that prejudice that it's not important to know about the, again, social context, social experience, and social history. And, you know, take a community in Philadelphia, you know, and these communities change rapidly over time, a neighborhood. And, you know, aren't there things we should know about the neighborhoods in which we work or that are gleaming, towering hospitals abut? I think we should not give up on pushing that part of medical training, which we just refer to as social medicine, in doing that. And to me, to have a social worker or an MPH who's a clinical coordinator coordinating medical education, I would, you know, do whatever you can to underline the importance of this as part of the exercise of learning social medicine. And there, like I said, there are formal programs at Penn, but not all medical students have access to them.
Here's one that I'll be interested in. How do you see climate change impacting your work at Partners in Health? And you talk a little bit about the sort of encroachment on the forests and the jungles, but, you know, on a bigger scale globally, how do you see it impacting your work
Well, you know, as we say in the lab, TNTC, too numerous to count. You know, there's just so many ways. In addition, but I would start, since we're talking about Ebola, and, you know, look at the newspapers today and, you know, all this fuss about the origin story of the SARS-CoV-2 virus, you know, that causes COVID-19. I mean, you know, this idea that's, you know, been manipulated in a lab or released from a lab, I find that very unlikely, given that, you know, it sounds to me like your typical interspecies jump in an area where, you know, the environment has been radically disrupted and Mother Nature isn't happy about it. That's where Ebola came from. And it's probably where, you know, MERS, SARS, and the new SARS virus, they're probably related to these ecological disruptions, which, you know, no doubt will unleash many new pathogens or old pathogens that have been forgotten about. I mean, a lot of the infectious pathogens, particularly viruses that cause serious disease in humans, are zoonoses. They come from another species. And so knowing about that is an important part of our, you know, understanding of how Partners in Health and any other provider will be affected. In addition, you know, since we're talking about Sierra Leone, when you see in the space, you know, in the space of an hour, an entire mountainside, you know, collapse and kill 1,000 people, you know, others injured badly, you know, how is that unrelated to climate change, deforestation? When you see in the American West what's going on with wildfires, you know, and just look at the sky. I didn't, you know, I wasn't there, but look at it in a newspaper photograph and imagine that isn't altering the lungs and well-being of people far away. To look, you know, I'm a Floridian, so I'm also going to think about rising seawater and salination of, you know, freshwater sources. So Partners in Health has been deeply affected already. You know, you could just say, well, as temperatures rise, so do mosquitoes go up higher on, you know, on a hillside. And Lesotho, where we've worked for long years, you know, we used to say, we'll never have to worry about malaria up here because, you know, what mosquito could survive this? Well, it won't be long, just as we see in Rwanda, you know, which had brought malaria under very good control. You know, we see resurgences and we see cases at higher and higher elevations. So Partners in Health is just like any other healthcare provider facing real challenges around climate change. And one of the things that we did in launching this university in Rwanda, which is led by the great Dr. Agnes Binagwahu, who you knew as the health minister in Rwanda, she's been to Penn to speak, you know, and she's a pediatrician. When, you know, in pulling together the key ideas for the university, you know, we regarded that term One Health, you know, which involves veterinary science, et cetera, as an extension of or fitting very naturally under the umbrella of social medicine yet again.
Fantastic. You know, here's a great question. Yes, the argument for provision of medical needs is convincing, but don't we take it too far when we use available funds for sophisticated surgical suites, even transplant capability in lieu of community-based immunization, TB control, et cetera? And I'm thinking also reading about your wishes in terms of staff for critical care specialists and that level of interventional kind of care and involvement.
Well, I mean, I think I've already tipped my hand, you know, Steve. I mean, with all due respect, I would say, no, I don't see it that way. Why should we pit surgical care in the fanciest suite imaginable against vaccination? Why don't we pit it against militarization, the massive tax breaks that are going to billionaires? You know, I just don't understand why we in health would make that, you know, opposition, but I've heard it all my life. And, you know, just to go back to the earthquake in Haiti, 2010, you know, I had another unpleasant experience with a public health guru, not from Haiti. I won't mention the country she was from, although it had a long history of colonial oppression of Haiti.
And, you know, we just remember, first of all, I had been working there a long time and lost a lot of friends. And, you know, it was still raw after, that was a, far and away the worst, you know, year of my life. The, you know, the around and after the earthquake, and then came cholera 7 months later. So in the course of a day, all of Haiti's teaching hospitals were destroyed. And then, you know, the nursing hospital, the National Nursing Hospital, which was right next to the General Hospital in downtown Port-au-Prince, collapsed, and almost none of the third year students survived, nor did their faculty. It was 4:53 in the afternoon, they were in class. So after all this horrible loss and mayhem, you also have a lot of injured people, you know, crushed by buildings, who needed surgery, but in order to deliver it, you had to put in place a field hospital, right? So some months later, and Partners in Health was lucky enough to receive a lot of unsolicited donations. And so we got together and said, you know, what we should really build is the teaching hospital that we always needed with proper surgical suites as well. So when we proposed it, we weren't even asking these international, you know, gurus and experts for their money. We were just really trying to be team players and say, hey, here's what we're planning as our big post-earthquake project as Partners in Health with the Ministry of Health. You know, this expert said, well, you know, surely now is not the time to be thinking about building, you know, an academic medical center. You know, and I just stood there and I finally gathered my wits enough to say, well, if it's not time now, after all of their teaching hospitals have been destroyed, when will it ever be time? So we just ignored them and built it. And we built six beautiful operating rooms, really fancy. I mean, you can look at a surgical procedure at the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston that's going on in Haiti. You know, it's connected to God or whatever the internet is that, you know, makes it possible to do this. All the, you know, by the way, Haiti had not a single CAT scanner in all of its public hospitals. And so we put one in, you know, and you can read those in Boston as well at the Mass General and the Brigham. So, you know, and within, and there had never been an emergency medicine training program in Haiti, as you know. So within, within a couple of years of opening it, we recruited the first class of emergency medicine residents, all women, and also a wonderful crackerjack team of surgical residents. People came back from the diaspora. A Haitian nurse, really even born in California, if I'm not mistaken, a really serious, experienced surgical nurse, she came back. And a surgeon who'd worked for two decades at Harlem Hospital, he came back and became chief of surgery. As she became, she's not the chief nursing officer, but the chief nursing officer had grown up in Florida. So, so bringing this all together, within a couple of years, we're training them, and now the first cohort of emergency doctors has already been graduated, Haiti's first, and this hospital residency programs have been accredited by the same accrediting institution that you have to, you know, deal with at CHOP. And that was the first such hospital accredited, not just in Haiti, but probably in the Caribbean. So, and by the way, those fancy operating rooms are the busiest trauma center in Haiti. And it's not even on a main road. I mean, it's referrals because the other hospitals are not functioning well enough to manage the trauma care, which is largely from accidents as it is, and sometimes gunshot wounds, unfortunately, like in Philly. But, you know, I have no regrets. And we still do the vaccination campaigns. In fact, that's what I was working on with the Minister of Health herself today, tonight, was trying to link them to the Biden White House to help Haiti get the vaccines that it needs. So, you know, I just would plead to the extent I'm allowed to, that we, you know, do less of that, you know, pitting our own selves against ourselves, really, because to me, you know, vaccination, tuberculosis control, family planning, all that is part of the minimum basic package, yes, but so is trauma care, and so is mental health, so are mental health services, so is intensive care when it's needed, And I've needed it in my lifetime, and I'm glad it's available in Haiti. And so are a lot of people who've survived really bad COVID up in that same hospital, which is the National Referral Center for COVID Care as well.
No, I totally understand. You know, again, if you're going to treat the whole patient, the whole community, you can't just be lecturing at them. You really have to come at them with something that gives them faith in you as a provider and a participant. And so, yeah, it's a part of the full package.
I just want to say I'm so grateful for that question. And that was just my passionate lived experience response. It's not umbrage. I did feel umbrage to the French PD. Oops, I said I wasn't going to say her nationality. I did feel umbrage then. You know, I just thought that was not the right thing for her to say.
Here's a good one, and we can end on this. It asks, where does the majority of your funding come from, and what qualifications and approval do you need to practice healthcare in other countries?
Well, that is a great question. Partners in Health to this day is still the majority of the donations that we receive are from individuals. They're philanthropic donations. But when, a new program comes along, and, I have to admit, I was as delighted and stunned as others when George W. Bush became the great champion of AIDS care, because before that we had AIDS control over care. And, those kind of programs can really alleviate a lot of the strain on a group like Partners in Health, which was going to take care of AIDS patients no matter what, regardless of what, public health and development economists said. So, but still the majority of, and the other, so that's like one chunk is governments, like the Rwandan government has been the most generous of all. We built a beautiful hospital in northern Rwanda, a public hospital. By the way, I didn't really say it, but the hospitals we build and run are all public hospitals. We're trying to add up to more than the sum of our parts as an NGO. Within a year or so, they were paying 70% of all the staff salaries. So, and in Haiti too, one hospital we're running, they're paying about 30% of the staff, right? So if you look at a pie chart, more than half private donations, a quarter of those government, sometimes US government support, and another quarter from foundations. That's about how it runs, I think. And if I'm wrong, it's online on the website, I would imagine. So the qualifications, there's a formal credentialing, right? So, if you're working even as a professor in Rwanda, a medical professor, you have to be credentialed by the Rwandan Medical Association, not unlike, in the United States. I think that's really the right way to proceed, right? But I'm only talking about if you're a physician practicing as a physician. What if you're a health educator or a hospital manager? A lot of different health professionals have different forms of credentialing. And one thing I've learned over the last 40 years is that the people we meet, including patients who say, well, I'd like to go to nursing school or I'd like to go to medical school. I never scoff at that or dismiss that, regardless of the station or how many years of high school they've gone through, if they have at all. So we focus most of our attention on credentialing people who are working in Haiti or Haitian or Rwandans working in Rwanda, or that's where the majority of our focus on credentialing goes. But to be a health activist and get involved in global health equity, the primary qualification is that you have heart and humility and that you want to help people. And, if that sounds corny, who cares? It's not corny at all. Those personal qualities that would help you work in a soup kitchen in Philadelphia or in a hospice center in Boston or anywhere else in the world, those are the most important. And so I would like students and, as we say, lay people alike to understand that what we really need is a stance and an attitude of pragmatic solidarity. As you said, Steve, if we end up lecturing and hectoring people who aren't even patients because we're not providing care, that isn't the way to proceed at all. But if you have heart, if you have love, fellow feeling for your fellow humans, especially those in trouble, injured, hurt, oppressed, sick, there's room for everybody in this work.
Fantastic. That's a great response, Paul. And I will highlight to the audience that, you know, when you have a platform like Partners in Health, and you lecture out to an audience of 100 people, maybe 50% of those people want to give their money to the NRA, but there's 50% of the people out there who want to support causes that are passionate and have clarity. And so Partners in Health is a great example, and pick and choose, but they can always use your support. It's money gets used wisely, and so your resources are put to a good cause.
Well, I can't. I just want to thank. I see it's a very robust crowd, and I wish I were there at the free library as I was last time, in person. I look forward to coming back to Philadelphia as soon as I can, which, you know, if things go well, is right around the corner for all of us.
We have a long overdue opportunity to get some beverages and some good food and talk some more about opportunities with you guys.
Terrific.
It's always a pleasure listening to you, and thank you for the opportunity to introduce you. And thank you. And again, everybody who's joined, be safe. Have a great night. I think it's starting to rain outside, so stay dry. All right?
Thanks, Steve. Thank you all.
I'll take care.
You too. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.